Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome again to our second hour in Circles of Change. It's a pleasure to have Bruce Frankel from New York City on the line. Bruce, how's everything in New York this day?
Everything is wonderful in New York today. It is a magnificent day here, which is nice after the long, cold winter.
Isn't that the truth? That's great. Well, for our listeners who may not have come to us every month or even catch the end of the month, we always have a pleasure of connecting with Bruce. He's a multiple-time New York Times best-selling author in a variety of venues. Later in his career, decided to step off and study poetry and came back then to spend some time doing research by meeting a cast of real characters, individuals over 60 who've shifted their lives in a major way to new things. And the book is What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? It's been getting a lot of regard. In fact, supported and presented by many organizations to help individuals think about that next big step. And Bruce, this topic isn't just related to those you write about, but also to your own journey, isn't it?
It is. It's very much related to my own journey. Began, and in fact, partially as a result of my own journey, when I went back to Sarah Lawrence and began to try to recover the possibility that I initially had staked out for myself when I was in my 20s of becoming a poet. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and now more recently, new possibilities.
That's great. Well, what are some of those possibilities? And I think that is indeed the word we wanted to talk about, that we're never too old or never too young to blank, blank, blank.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, my own possibilities. One of the things that I've been researching now is dance and movement in the brain, and that springs as well from the book and from my own experience. In the book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life, Thomas Dwyer. I'm sorry.
They're your office mate. I love it.
Yeah, they're my office mate.
Exactly.
They never do this when they're supposed to. Anyway,
any of us who have dogs, my dogs are quiet as mice until I suddenly have a conference call, and then they completely blow my cover that I work from home in a large home office, so I understand completely. So they're probably wanting to chime in about possibilities there, Bruce.
They are. but they were just walks, so it's not the possibility of going out.
So dance movement and the brain.
Yeah, yes, and one of the characters in my book, people in the book, Thomas Dwyer, began dancing late in life, in his 50s. In his 70s, he continues to be a performer, and we've talked about Thomas a little before, and when I was doing that research, I uncovered research that had been done on the brain and dance and how much benefit it has for the brain. In fact, it's the only activity that was found in a long research project, which we discussed last time, that seems to have a significant protective factor against Alzheimer's and dementia in the Einstein aging study.
Mm-hmm.
So that was married to my interest in, as a child, from the time I was about 6 years old, I recently asked my mother to kind of figure it out. She's now almost 90. How it came about that it was determined I had no rhythm, which is what I've carried with me my whole life. And to the fact that I didn't dance, I didn't listen to much music, I didn't buy records. I listened very closely when my children practiced music. When I would attempt to do anything or play anything myself, I would freeze and become anxious and not be able to do anything. And it was always a great sadness to me.
Mm-hmm.
So as one of the things that I decided that I would do with the book that I'm currently working on, it was to research what would happen if I studied tango for a year and we saw what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
More recently, my eldest son, I have three, Alex, is in a band called Holy Ghost, and I know you're going to be talking to Alex later.
Right next,
And he was making a music video, wanted to make a music video for the release of his, to go with the release of his album, Holy Ghost, and a new song called Wait and See, and asked me and his musical partner, Nick's Millhiser's father, Tim, if we would consider doing a music video for him. And I was frozen with fear at first.
Yeah.
Because it went up against everything that I had lived for 60 years.
And all those voices in your head that said, well, you can't do that. You don't have rhythm.
Absolutely.
Right.
And and even though I'd recently spoken to a woman who's been doing research on beat, or actually functionally beat deaf, but I wasn't convinced. Alex came over, in fact, a couple of nights before the shoot and played a couple of bars from the song, Wait and See, and asked me to sing along. And no sooner had I begun than Alex put his head in his hands and said, oh my, I forgot.
Oh no.
What was I thinking? And I was stricken by even more fear than ever because I didn't want to, of course, disappoint
your
him.
Son, yeah.
And so forth. So he left loops with me to play on the computer and on headphones. And I listened constantly for the next 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And sang along with the loops and moved to loops in front of a mirror. And the oddest thing happened, which is kind of what research bears out about brain plasticity. Now, whether my brain actually shifted or something within me shifted,
mm-hmm.
the truth is that when we went to do this video, which is now online everywhere, the blogs are going crazy with it. In fact, one blog in England dedicated it to the royal wedding yesterday.
Oh, yeah, you've arrived. Bruce, Dad, you have arrived.
Yeah.
So two days you listened to the loops of the
days.
3.5 to 4 minutes of this song.
And listened for hours. And just kept listening to loops and going over and over. And when we did it, I mean, I was still nervous the day we were doing it and still anxious, and I'm sure I wasn't on rhythm. Alex stood behind the camera and signaled me a little on a rhythm. But I think overall everyone would agree that I wasn't terribly offbeat,
mm-hmm.
which all my life people had told me from the time I was in first grade in chorus, teachers would say, you know what, Bruce, why don't you wait until why don't you not sing?
In fact, why don't you be the audience and watch?
Why don't you write? Exactly.
You support the group and be the audience. Oh, yes.
Right. So, you know, that's my personal little story on possibility. But, you know, I see much broader implications for it, of course. I think one of the things that happens, possibility is not the same as prediction, of course. And prediction leads us into certain bit of tunnel vision that is not as really so good for us. Possibility is really leaving open the chance that if you discipline yourself and you work at something and you invest yourself and you engage in something, particularly if it's related to a strength that you have,
mm-hmm,
I mean,
right.
Then you really have just what the word says, the possibility of accomplishing something. You know, we're so busy and we're taught so often throughout our lives to close the door on possibility and to not live a very mindful life in terms of, you know, I think that one of the things about possibility is that if we're really mindful about paying attention to the moments that we're living in, instead of worrying about what could or what we fear will happen, but really pay attention, you know, things open up. You know, they just do. And I think, you know, Ellen Langer, who's a wonderful writer and social psychologist at Harvard and has written a book called Counterclockwise, The Power of Possibility, has researched this for over a decade or more, 20 years, and has shown through science and rigorous testing that that's true.
Well, you know, what you often think is many times in our days when we're confronted with something that we haven't encountered before and take that risk, many times it's, well, what if negative? Well, what if it doesn't work? What if I make a fool of myself? What if I trip up? Well, if we have to redo it? What if there isn't? And how many times instead, what if we shifted that to what if positive? Gee, what if I got it right? What if I surprised myself? And so there might be a double loop here. Some people might be afraid of being successful in something that really is different as well. There's still some comfort in staying stuck where they are, whether they hate it or whether it's mediocre or whether it just feels safe. So what if positive?
I think you're right, and I think the what if positive is, and I think there's, you know, when you look at what happened to in the history of psychology over the last 60 or more years, the culture was shifted by this notion of diagnosing illness and creating a kind of victimology in which we looked at why things were wrong. Each of us inspected ourselves for what our problems were when we, rather than for what our possibilities were. And, you know, Martin Seligman, who's the father of positive psychology, writes about this in, as well, and has talked about how he has hoped to shift the psychology more to seeing ways to achieve happiness and well-being rather than addressing what's wrong with our lives. And you know, it's interesting because as a result of the focus on diagnosing what's wrong and so forth, we ended up in this world in which either you were happy or not happy, mm-hmm. when the truth is that's not really the dichotomy that's useful in life. You know, if you invest yourself in the possibility, say, of having a meaningful life or a life in which that you're capable of flow and engaged in creative effort, that's not necessarily going to be always a happy life.
No, in fact, there's along your lines of your music video debut this week, I also encountered a song, it might not be that new, by Laura's Story called Blessings, a faith-based song. And the real message of it is, who's to say that our times of tears and struggle really aren't the blessings or the mercies of life that are now going to lead us to the next thing? It's
that's
beautiful
a great
song.
Point.
Beautiful song.
That's very nice. I'll write that down. That's a great. And you know, along these lines too, I think I mentioned to you this. My thinking on this began to evolve yesterday when I read a poem by Yusuf Komunyakaa called "Kindness," and he's really a beautiful poet and jazz. Jazz-influenced poet in which language approaches music. And the end of the song, the end of the poem, he asks, what do we need to measure kindness? Every unheld breath, every unkind year. And then he says, the final lines are, sometimes a sober voice is enough to calm the waters and drive away the false witnesses, saying, look, here are the broken treaties, beauty brought to us, earthbound sentinels. You know, and that's really that last part. Look, here are the broken treaties, beauty brought to us, earthbound sentinels. And that's where I see this notion of if we really pay attention, if we give ourselves over to tenderness towards existence, if we see the beauty that surrounds us and we engage in acts of possibility, amazing things can happen.
Well, and I think it isn't just possibility for ourselves. If we also work in that same fashion to help others do it for themselves as well, it makes it all the more powerful.
Oh, you're so right. And in fact, you know, Seligman's research and others, Chizmam Sahali, I can never pronounce his name, but you know, their research has shown that there are three kinds of happy lives: the pleasant life, the life of engagement and the meaningful life. And when they broke that down and they researched further, what they found is that life lived for pleasure and pleasant things and just accomplishment for the self really doesn't have the same power as life lived for engagement and meaning. Life lived that does things that's meaningful, particularly, and meaningful generally means doing things that help others, that create greater life for others. That trumps everything. That trumps money. That trumps anything you can think of.
Yeah, well, well put. For those of you who just tuned in, we're speaking with my broadcast partner, Bruce Frankel, who wrote the book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? He's mentioned here in our discussion two books you might want to note. One was by Ellen Langer, The Counterclockwise, The Power of Possibility. And then, of course, one of the granddaddies from Martin Singleman, Positive Psychology. Bruce, take us back, you know, this whole talk to maybe one or two of the individuals in your book about what should I do with the rest of my life, how this really has played out so strongly in their stories, and how they shifted in this post-age 60, whatever that hallmark might be.
Well, as I've said before, many of the people in the book in What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life had no idea what they were going to become or how they would get there. Later today, I'm going up to what's called the Gaga Arts Festival in Garnerville, New York, where I'm going to do a book signing. But it's a celebration. It's an arts festival. But there's a river that runs alongside Garnerville where they have now works by Ted Levitsik, who is a sculptor in my book. And I think I may have mentioned Ted before. When Ted was in his 60s, he discovered some rocks in the river and started carving. He had no previous experience.
Mm-hmm, carving, yeah.
But he had a vision and started and continued. You know, now 20-odd years later, he's collected all over, and they're trying to dedicate this area of Garnerville to Ted's works. So, you know, he's one example. There are other, you know, amazing examples in the book. I've always loved, I would say, quaint or simple ones like Loretta Thayer, who opened up a defunct diner because she wanted to create for her community a place of good food and good fellowship. And everyone discouraged her from doing it because they said, we live in a fast food nation. Mm-hmm. There's no way your idea is going to succeed.
Other than, of course, the context. This was how the 9/11 tragedies impacted her, right? So this was a way for her to give back and bring that community.
Exactly. And to bring community and for her to do something. She couldn't do, she was 6 hours away from New York City. There wasn't anything she could really do. But it's what stimulated her thinking, I want to do this. And but I was always struck by even the bankers she first went to see said they wouldn't lend the money because people don't want to sit down and they'd want fast food, they told her, and so they weren't willing to back her first. But then finally one banker said to Loretta, you know, I'm listening to you, and I listen to how much you want to do this, and I believe in you. And so he lent her the money to start her diner, which is now, you know, flourishing. People line up in the morning for hours, mm-hmm. and so forth. You know, there's the Smiths. I'm not sure if we've ever spoken of them, but, you know, they created this household goods recycling of Massachusetts, where they began to collect from their community the discarded things that people would normally throw in the garbage, but are of great use and still, you know, whether it was pots and pans or toaster ovens or microwaves or TVs or mattresses or on and on and on, and started to just offer them for others to come and get. And this grew over the course of 20 years. They started when they were 60, started schlepping. The two of them, she weighs all of about 90 pounds, started schlepping in their little truck you know, refrigerators, stoves.
Exactly,
people would
yeah.
look at people would look at them like they were out of their minds. Their kids looked at them like they were out of their minds. But it grew, and today, you know, there are 160 people who work for the organization as volunteers. They give away millions of dollars of goods each year that people donate from the community, and people who are coming out of treatment, out of hospitals, out of centers for battered women are helped enormously because they can move into an apartment and have everything you can imagine.
They have become, the Smiths have become connectors for a multiple of agencies that help facilitate this for those under their care.
Absolutely.
So it's a network thing they've created.
That's absolutely right. There are 500 agencies in the greater Boston area that now depend upon them. And, you know, so a little bit of, you know, action and the belief that you can do something and discipline of doing it, these things, accrue.
So reflect on that for me to what you've been currently doing then, Bruce, from the point of you going on this journey to learn through the stories of these other people, writing your own book, and now, just as you mentioned, you're about to go on another speaking engagement, and lo and behold, at the same time, perhaps part of your ministry, just as you've pushed your own boundaries, into being in a rock video.
Well, you know, again, I couldn't have predicted. In fact, yeah. I probably didn't do a lot of these things years ago because I was afraid. I didn't really believe that I could do them. And even writing, though I'd written my whole life, writing a book was, I created it in my mind as a monumental task rather than seeing it as something that I could do a day at a time, essentially, mm-hmm. and work towards. And I really don't feel I guess the cardinal lesson for me out of all of this is that if you, rather than creating an outsized goal, if you create a vision and then move backwards and think, okay, so what do I have to do over the next 3 months to make this happen? Mm-hmm. What do I have to do over the next month? What do I have to do? What one thing today do I have to do to make this happen?
In fact, what I call that with my clients, in fact, I just met with a client this week, a very talented individual that runs a very successful business. But honestly, between the two of us, we voiced that he's outgrown the business. It's time to move on. But he sits paralyzed, I think, more out of fear. So to say, look, this isn't worrying about the how, all the steps, as you would say, but really, what is the desired outcome? And then, as you said, one step at a time. But the other piece, if you do it one step at a time, then you can be mindful and open to the possibility that something might come right across your bow that'll leap you 50 steps towards it, as opposed to just one step at a time.
And it always does.
It really does.
That's the queer thing. You know, you know, we say these words, but the truth is when you live this, suddenly you become aware of how true that is. And it's chilling sometimes because it's really beyond your imagination.
And it'll pull you faster than perhaps you might be ready. So you just grab a hold. Well, Bruce Frankel, thank you so much again for a great segment. His book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? And stay tuned after our commercials and bottom of the hour, because we'll now hear the other side of the story from son Alec and his colleague Nick Milheiser from Holy Ghost on Indeed, the video that featured their dads. Thanks a lot, Bruce. Have a great afternoon.
Well, thank you, Zara. You're great, and be well.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, 877-544-2580.